Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings, I'm Tom Gilson. Today on ID the Future, we continue our series of messages from a symposium in Berkeley, California, presented in honor of the late Philip E. Johnson, who played a crucial role in the growth of the intelligent design movement. Today, Dr. Michael Behe, author of Darwin's Black Box, The Edge of Evolution, and Darwin Devolves, speaks on the long history of science, how ancient science pointed to purposeful design in life, and how current science is coming full circle back to the same conclusion.
It's wonderful to be included in this tribute to Phil, and I met Phil pretty early, but I had already been an evolution skeptic when I did meet him. I read a book by a man named Michael Denton 5 years earlier, and it convinced me that Darwinian processes could not explain what we find in biology. But for the next 5 years, I kind of buttonholed colleagues in the chemistry department at Lehigh University and said rude things about evolution to them, and it was not really very effective. But serendipitously, I met Phil, and he had gathered, you know, a bunch of people around him, many of whom are on the stage, and I got plugged into his network and got the ideas through him and the contacts to be able to write a book myself. And so that's one of the things Phil did so very, very well. He was an original thinker, but he was also a schmoozer. He would gather people together and organize things and efficiently challenge an idea. And that idea that we were, well, not challenging, the idea we had to challenge the received wisdom is one that was held by pretty much everybody in the entire world for most of history. For example, I'm sure you know the psalm, "I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made," written by King David. And, well, how did he know he was fearfully and wonderfully made? Well, he could see his fingers, and he could use his eyes and ears to hear, and so on. But as science advanced, what happened? Well, another 1,000 years after the ancient Hebrews, there was a man named Galen who was a physician in Rome and arguably the best classical scientist of the classical age. And he pioneered anatomy and dissection of animals to see what was inside these guys, making them move. And he wrote in one of his books that the human body is the result of, quote, "a supremely intelligent and powerful divine craftsman." That is the result of intelligent design. And he was saying this from his anatomical work. Flash forward another 1,500 years or so, and many of you may recognize the name of William Paley, who was a pretty good amateur biologist, and using the data accumulated up through the ages, he, of course, made a very strong argument for intelligent design. His classic example is the watch that one would find in a field. And he remarked that if you found a watch, you would immediately know that it was designed because you see how the parts are shaped to allow the function of the watch. But then, of course, in the later 1800s, Charles Darwin went on his voyage in the HMS Beagle and saw a lot of things that no European had ever seen before, including things like Galapagos finches that differed from each other and differed from mainland varieties. And he scratched his head and said, you know, how can we explain that? And he came up with his theory of evolution by natural selection, where small variations helped these birds survive in new niches. But the thing is that biology has progressed since then. Turns out that in Darwin's day, the cell was thought to be a little simple piece of jelly, protoplasm, molecules, theoretical entities. Nobody was sure if they existed. Nonetheless, if you look at many biology and evolutionary texts and ask people, they still think in terms of finches or dinosaurs with feathers or fish crawling up onto the beach with, you know, proto legs. But that's not how we know biology is constituted. Instead, we know that there is a foundational level of life, the cellular and molecular level that modern science has discovered in the past 75 years or so. And we know that the cell is chock full of information in the form of DNA. Darwin didn't know about DNA. He didn't know anything about heredity. What's more, that little piece of jelly turns out to be chock full of molecular machines, literally machines made out of molecules. If you've ever seen, say, Star Trek and saw the Borg have this, one of their features is they're run by nanotechnology. Well, you have orders of magnitude more nanotechnology running you than the Borg does. And in my book, Darwin's Black Box, I wrote that these machines now are very strong challenges to Darwin's theory. Here's a nice drawing, I think the best illustration of a molecular machine. This is the bacterial flagellum, which quite literally is an outboard motor that bacteria use to swim. And like other machines, it's got multiple pieces. It's got a piece that acts as a propeller, a universal joint, a drive shaft, a motor, a stator, clamps, all sorts of stuff. Now, one of the problems with machines is that you have to have the machine pretty much together in order for it to work. And I wrote in Darwin's Black Box that we could use the term irreducible complexity for that. And I illustrated it with a mousetrap, that if you take away the spring of a mousetrap or a hammer of a mousetrap or any of the pieces, it doesn't work. Same thing with the flagellum or any of the thousands of molecular machines in your cells, that if you take pieces away, they don't work. But Darwin's theory needs gradual change, where random mutation provides things that can be selected in tiny steps over a long period of time. But now, with the very progress of science, we see that's not the way life works. And so Darwin has a big problem at the molecular level. Okay, so that's a problem for Darwin, and many of these other things are a problem for Darwin. What points us to intelligent design? So what's the positive argument for intelligent design? Well, if you look in the dictionary, design is defined as the purposeful arrangement of parts. So we conclude that something was designed when we see parts that have been arranged for a purpose. And a good example of that is shown here. So you see this troop of jungle explorers here, and this lead explorer has been strung up and skewered. And this guy turns to this guy and says, "That's why I walk in front. Why I never walk in front." And let me tell you, that's a great idea. But the thing is that everybody here, if you look at this cartoon, you immediately realize that this trap was designed. That's no accident. As a matter of fact, the humor of the cartoon depends upon you recognizing the design. How do you know it's designed? You know it's designed because you see parts that have been arranged for a purpose. Our minds can perceive purposes. That's what minds do. And we see it in the purposeful arrangement of parts. And now we have found an exceedingly complex purposeful arrangement of parts all over life. So irreducible complexity, it turns out, has a double use. Number one, it's a big, big problem for Darwin because he has to produce things gradually. But second, it's a very strong pointer to design because irreducibly complex systems are purposeful arrangement of parts, just like that flagellum, just like the mousetrap. Some further work, as Paul Nelson was saying, in the past 20 years or so, science has gone crazy in being able to sequence DNA, and we have tons of data that did not exist before. And now it has become possible to track down mutations that could not be tracked down before. It's important to realize that Darwin's theory has to be evaluated at the molecular level because mutations are changes in molecules. They're changes in DNA and the proteins that it codes for. Well, a number of helpful mutations have been sequenced recently. And it turns out that there's been, you know, a very surprising result. And the result is that the great majority of helpful mutations, ones that benefit a species, ones that make the species increase in population numbers, are degradatory mutations. That is, they break or degrade genes that were already there in the organism. Just as one example, for the rest you'll have to read that Darwin DeVos book. The polar bear is thought to have evolved from the grizzly bear, the brown bear. The entire DNA of both grizzly bears and polar bears has been sequenced, and was sequenced about 5-6 years ago. And it turns out that of the 17 most favored mutations, 3/4 of them break or degrade pre-existing genes. And yet, when we look at the polar bear, we think, wow, look at that magnificent animal. Even things that impress us as improvements, very often, most of the time, are the result of degradative mutations. So I think it doesn't really need saying that a degradative process is not one that's going to build these things in the first place. Rather, science in its progress, and unintentionally, is showing that only a mind can build and purposely arrange materials. And as science progresses, we're seeing that that arrangement and that the need for design extends ever deeper into life.
That was Dr. Michael Behe speaking at a November 2019 symposium convened in honor of the late Philip E. Johnson. There's still more to come from this gathering, so keep an eye on ID the Future on your favorite podcast app or at idthefuture.com. For ID the Future, I'm Tom Gilson. Thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.